to talk a little bit about where the military meets the law. We have one of this country's most seasoned veterans and military attorneys with us today. John Maher of Maher Legal Services is a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel. Listen to this. He is an expert, federal litigation, national security, veterans advocacy, has 28 active years of experience and reserve military experience in Germany. He was deployed to the Balkans, served two tours in Afghanistan. After leaving active duty, he served as a Department of Justice litigator. He holds a law degree, a master's of business, a master's of law, and a master's degree from the Army War College, and most recently has led teams that have secured full presidential pardons for two military veterans in very high-profile cases. John, thank you so much for joining us on this Memorial Day.
Thank you, Karen. That was a very gracious introduction. Much obliged, and I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it's all true. So, you know, I guess let's start with this. I've heard people criticize when people say Happy Memorial Day and say, you know, all these barbecues and pool parties should be something that shouldn't happen on Memorial Day. You're a veteran. You're a person who delves into this world. What is your answer to that?
Well, my answer to that is, first and foremost, Memorial Day is for those that fell in the line of duty. Veterans Day is for those who served, and Armed Forces Day is for those who are currently serving right now. I do believe that those who fell and are represented by Memorial Day would not mind whatsoever if the people they fell for are enjoying swimming pools and hot dogs and baked beans and their family and their friends, because after all, they answered the call, they went, and they did so for our particular brand of American freedom. So I think it's quite all right, Taryn, to say Happy Memorial Day, and you're not disrespecting anyone who fell because of those reasons I just stated.
That makes me feel better, a lot better. You have a great...
Well, thank you, ma'am.
You have a great story. I like how you call me ma'am. That's so military. you have a great story that you told me about the origins of Arlington National Cemetery. Can you share that with our listeners?
I'd be happy to, Karen. And for those of us who have been to the nation's capital, right across the Potomac River is Arlington National Cemetery, where many of our nation's heroes who fell in the line of duty and their spouses and vice versa are now entombed or interred. Back in 1861, when the American Civil War broke out, President Lincoln offered then United States Colonel Robert E. Lee command of the Union forces at Blair House across the street from the White House. Then Colonel Lee turned the president down and said, I have to go with the Commonwealth of Virginia. So General Lee was not arrested. He was not arrested as a traitor or a deserter, but he was allowed by President Lincoln's proclamation to go back to Virginia, and President Jefferson Davis commissioned Robert E. Lee as the commander of the Army of the Potomac, strike that, of Northern Virginia. All of that to say, after the first Battle of Bull Run, which was one of the first major battles in the American Civil War, otherwise known as Manassas, then Brigadier General Montgomery Meigs had all of the deceased laying on the ground in the country on the McLean farm and had no idea what to do with these people. Every casualty was an American. So the decision was made to bury them in the front of Robert E. Lee's home, which is now Arlington National Cemetery. And they did that not only because many of the general officers fighting for the Union were also classmates of then General Lee, but also there was a measure of a political statement there. So for those reasons, that's why Arlington National Cemetery became Arlington National Cemetery. Huh. And if I could add one more thing to that, Karen, in terms of many people who might visit a national cemetery, whether it be in Illinois or Virginia or wherever, you'll see crosses and stars of David and what have you lined up in formation. There's a reason for that. Those soldiers stood in formation during life, and now on Memorial Day, when we recognize those who fell, they are also now resting in formation with one another.
Oh, interesting. You know, we have had the state treasurer, Michael Frerichs, on our show to talk about his Operation Purple Heart, which is a program which returns military medals to families. A lot of these things get put into safety deposit boxes, and after many years, the safety deposit boxes go to the state, and then he returns them. And he's had a couple of very heartwarming stories. I don't know if you followed that, John. But can you go through us what the military medals are and what qualifies a soldier for the medals?
Well, first and foremost, there's a lot in that question to unpack, Karen. But if I could go specifically to what the state treasurer is doing, I don't find that particularly atypical. A lot of people who've been through some turmoil, some trouble, combat, what have you, they don't really talk about it. So they might put their medals in the attic, they might put them in the chest, and they might put them in the safety deposit box. So when those things, I think you were calling it a sheet to the state, I think it's wonderful that the treasurer is going to return these things. And perhaps if the treasurer needs a task force of other veterans to find those people to return them to family, there's numbers of us that can do that. Well, the most senior and the most distinguished medal is the Medal of Honor. Some used to call it the Congressional Medal of Honor. That's no longer the right name. It's the Medal of Honor. And that's, candidly, I believe that most recipients of it would say to you, were they alive? Because many of them are posthumously awarded. You receive it. You don't earn it. And most of the people who have received that are going to say it was the worst day of their lives. So the Medal of Honor is the highest award we have for military action in the face of the enemy, and the standard is you've gone above and beyond the call of duty. Beneath that is the Distinguished Service Cross, then the Silver Star, then the Bronze Star. But each of those requires individual actions under fire against the enemy. There's so many other medals out there and campaign ribbons and what have you, but I think those are the main three, four combat awards and or overseas and hostile fire zone awards.
You were both a prosecutor and a defense lawyer during your service in the Army. Without getting, you know, really into the weeds about this, how are the laws, the criminal laws in the Army, in the military, different from our laws? And just generally, what are the goals and how are the goals different in our criminal justice system versus military system?
Thank you, Karen. And first and foremost, I'd like to establish this. The United States Constitution applies no matter who and where you are and what status you are in. So, for example, if you are a member of the United States military on active duty, the Constitution of the United States that you swore to protect and defend goes with you. Mainly years ago, back when General Washington was starting our Continental Army and our Continental Congress was vesting General Washington with powers to regulate his force, his militia, and his force, the main reason for military law was to maintain good order and discipline. Now, that is not the case anymore. The military rules of evidence apply equally, and the cases now have grown into a body of jurisdiction and jurisprudence, meaning a body of law, such that Americans standing facing trial and court-martial are entitled, I would believe, to all of the same rights. And some of the things we're trying to do right now in our private practice is to ensure that a person who is also our brother and sister American who did not put the uniform on, that our uniform members enjoy the same protections. So I do believe there's a closeness, but there's still work to do to bring parity.
We're talking to John Maher. Can you give out, we're going to talk a little bit more about your practice after the break, but you represent veterans, you represent people in pardons, you represent people in military issues and federal government workers. How can people reach you? Can you give out either your website or your phone number or both?
Well, thank you, Karen. Yes, www.lawyersdefendingwarriors.com. You could reach us at 708-781-9212. And there's three veterans organizations, Karen, that we think are just fantastic legitimate, reputable, that we work with regularly, hand in glove. The veterans of foreign wars, the American Legion, and the Reserve Organization of America. If you have any challenges when it comes to being a veteran, whether you need disability payments, educational assistance for your GI Bill, whether you want to pass your 911 GI Bill benefits to your son, daughter, or family member, these organizations are made up of your brothers and sisters who served, and they're standing ready to provide you expertise.
John, can you hold on with us through the break? And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about some of the pardon work that you did that ended up in a series called Leavenworth, if you've seen it. And I do want to talk a little bit about war crimes and what constitutes a war crime. John, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what your practice does? Just it's a kind of an interesting practice. It's very unique. And because you are a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel and you have 28 years of active and reserve military experience, you bring a definite spin to your practice. What is it you actually do?
Well, Karen, what we do is three main things. Right now, there's several cases where we think that the military justice system may have come up short. So we're seeking pardons from the President of the United States based upon the inequities, because, not to get too far in the weeds, and I know that we are pressed for time, but an American soldier, sailor, airman, Marine, Coast Guards, or Space Force person is not going to have a federal court look at their court-martial conviction upon separation of powers. We're working hard to get that done through the legislature, the Congress, the United States, and the President. Secondly, we're trying very difficultly, strike that hardly, to surmount another difficult hurdle. And that is the idea that there really shouldn't be deference to military authorities because when it comes to courts martial convictions, because Marbury versus Madison, dating back to 1803 in separation of powers, says that the courts are the final say of what the law is. The current state of the law is, pursuant to the Tenth Circuit decision in Lawrence v. Commandant, is apparently the federal courts are contented to let Lieutenant Colonel or a colonel who is not a professional jurist but a military officer managing his or her career be the final say of what the Constitution is. I don't think that feels right as a Lieutenant Colonel and as a former military officer like that.
So let's...
Moreover...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Karen. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
so, I was going to say the third part of the practice is, and I'm terribly sorry, ma'am, is I'm the former general counsel for the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, Washington, D.C., which is the personnel department for the federal government in large measure, except for a couple of agencies. So when you look at the tumult of some of the things that are happening right now and people are losing their jobs, and what people might not understand is when you're a federal employee, you don't have a contract and you're not at will. You have a statutory appointment under Title V, which means you have due process rights. And some of those due process rights in very deserving people are not being observed. And that's not any political administration whatsoever. Instead, usually there's personality-driven problems. We stand and we pick up those cases, and I'm very happy to report that there's many people who are deserving of continued federal service who are still there. So it's a blend of military law, civilian federal appellate practice, legislation, and I'd like to say problem solving. When it comes to anything related to the federal government and or state governments, police departments and fire departments, I do believe that we're able to receive the problem, analyze the problem, formulate courses of action, make recommendations, and then see the thing through.
Kind of a holistic approach to the federal government and military law. Let's just talk briefly. This is an issue that I always... I'm wondering about. So you have soldiers who are in combat all over the world, and they're being shot at, and they're shooting back. And occasionally you see these prosecutions of the soldiers when there's maybe friendly fire or there are issues. And these people get convicted, and they have long prison terms. So what is the law when you are fighting as a soldier? What are you allowed to do, and what are you not allowed to do?
Well, that can't be a complicated question. I mean, the answer is complicated, but not so much. First and foremost, under the Articles of War dating back before the Geneva Convention and the Uniform Code of Military Justice dating back to 1950, every soldier, every person who takes up arms in the United States forces is entitled to inherit self-defense. So you start with there. Then we have to listen to our leaders, because many times we're trained to locate, close with, and destroy the enemy by fire and maneuver, or repel the enemy's assault by fire and close combat. But when our mission changes, where we have to become civil affairs, diplomats, we have to become medical personnel and humanitarian relief operators, we haven't received sufficient training there. Then when our opponents in these last 20 years, 40, if you think about both theaters, meaning Iraq and Afghanistan and now Syria and Horn of Africa and wherever we are engaged, the opponent is going to use our own rules of engagement against us. So they're going to put noncombatants, otherwise known as women, children, protected targets, mosques, protected religious places, and then fire upon us, knowing that we will police ourselves. And therein lies a friction point between, are we sending the right people in for these missions? Because if you ask a Marine, you ask a paratrooper from the 82nd, well, their job is to go in there and carry the day. But then afterwards, who's going to come in and keep the peace?
John,
so, Karen,
let's...
Very difficult answer.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And I'm really sorry that we had this abbreviated version, but I want to get out your contact information. John Maher, Maher Legal Services. How can people reach you?
Thank you, Karen. We're at www.lawyersdefendingwarriors.com. We are at 708-781-9212. And we also, Karen, I would like to say this because it applies here to Illinois, too. Any person who is a National Guards person or a reservist, you have rights when it's time for you to go to weekend drill or summertime drill. And that law is called USERRA, Uniform Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act. That's another part of our practice where we're taking care of twice the citizen.